Well, please keep your Bible open there on page 498, there in Job chapter 3, although we'll be going back a little bit into Job chapter 1 and chapter 2 in the course of this second in this series entitled Why? On the whole book of Job. In one of U2's songs, Bono vents his deep frustration that despite the Christmas time refrain, peace on earth, the world appears light years away from peace. Given all the sorrow, given the pain, how can we ever sing about peace on earth? Bono finds that the words, to quote his song, are sticking in my throat. Many of us have suffered. Some of us are suffering. All of us will suffer. All we have to do is live long enough and we'll face personal circumstances that cause the words peace on earth perhaps to stick in our throats. As we saw last week, that day came for Job, and the great lesson we heard about Job's God, the God of the Bible, is this: that God rules even over suffering. God rules over suffering. That doesn't make the question of suffering any easier. If anything, it actually makes it harder. But it's such an important truth for us to learn and to believe in our hearts, before the icy winds of suffering begin to blow on us. And last week, those two words, kind of opposite words, but come together with a Christian heart, with a person of faith in the God of the Bible, bewildered and yet confident. Bewildered, confident. Bewildered, yes, in the face of suffering, but confident because things are not out of control, because God does rule over suffering. Well, today again, there's just one simple lesson, one simple point from Job. So we'll come straight to the first and to the last point of this one-point Bible talk on Job's sorrows. Job's sorrows were the result of innocent suffering. That's it. That's the one point. Job's sorrows were the result of innocent suffering. Job did not deserve to suffer. We, the readers, are time and again given poignant information about Job. He was a very good man. First of all, we're told, and look back at chapter 1 and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and who turned away from evil. He was a good man. Then we're told in chapter 1 and verse 5 how Job prayed for his children and he made sacrifices for them after they'd had a party. He was a father who, to quote somebody else, spent time with his kids for God's sake and yet also spent time with God for his kids' sake. That's a real lesson for any dad here today, to spend time with our kids for God's sake and yet also spend time with God for our kids' sake. Job knew the secret of good parenting. Knees are much more effective than nagging. How we kind of think as parents that nagging is what we'll do with our children. No, knees, praying on our knees to God for our children is much more effective than nagging. And that's the kind of father that Job was. He was a good man. He was an excellent father. He was a godly man, a man of faith and integrity and sincerity. Then in chapter 1 and verse 8, we hear from the mouth of God. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Following Job's first round of suffering, we're told in verse 22 of chapter 1, "In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong." Again, from the very mouth of God, we hear in chapter 2, verse 3, God speaking to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." And then following the second round of suffering, we're told chapter 2 and verse 10, that little section there, "In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He goes through the most terrible suffering, and yet he doesn't sin. He doesn't sin before, in that sense, there's an innocence about him, and he doesn't sin in terms of the way that he responds to his suffering. And we, you know, get the point. It can't be clearer. Before, during, immediately after the most horrific suffering, Job was a man who loved God, who loved God's ways, a man of utmost integrity and absolute sincerity. The writer's not saying, of course, that Job was sinless. Only one man in the Bible, one man in history, Jesus, was sinless. But it's absolutely clear that there was an innocence about Job that meant that he did not deserve to suffer as he did. He didn't deserve to suffer as he did. In fact, he suffered precisely because he was blameless. He didn't suffer as a result of sin. He actually suffered as a result of being blameless. He was innocent. The Bible says that we live in a fallen world, a world that's rebelled against God's rule and God himself. And the Bible teaches us that ultimately sin is the origin of all suffering. Sin is the origin of all suffering. That rings true with our experience. Quite a lot of our suffering can easily be directed and linked to sin. Break the law about drink and driving, and you will suffer. The Bible again and again, Deuteronomy, Proverbs, Romans, relate sin and suffering together. But the Bible never rules out the suffering, the kind of suffering that the book of Job considers. Job's sorrows were not related to any sin. And there is suffering which is not related to any sin. Like those school children murdered in Pakistan just prior to Christmas. No doubt they were like any other school children, imperfect, not innocent in any absolute sense at all. They no doubt got on each other's nerves. There were squabbles, no doubt. There was fighting. There was indiscipline probably in that school. That happens in every school, doesn't it? No doubt they got on their children's nerves, on their parent, or the teacher's nerves. Maybe some of them hadn't done their homework. But what on earth did they do? What sin did they commit that would make their brutal murders justifiable retribution? Nothing, surely. Someone else might have deserved what happened to Job. We might be able to think of a few names of people in history who we think deserve Job's kind of sorrows. But that's the issue. These things happened to Job. At the blink of an eye, this blameless man who loved God, loved God's ways, lost his livelihood, his children, his health, and the love and the respect of his wife. Well, we love to come up with simple solutions to suffering. We looked at one last week, today we're looking at another. It's called the theory of retribution. Don't be frightened of the title. It's very easy to understand. As I said, the Bible does link much suffering directly with sin. And that fits with what we observe and what we experience. But the theory of retribution says that all suffering is directly linked to specific sin. All suffering is directly linked to specific sin. We see it clearly in Hinduism, one of the oldest of the world's religions. Suffering is explained essentially as payback or as balance. So every experience of suffering, famine, disease, rape, earthquake, poverty, etc., is understood to be the operation of karma, the universal principle by which all actions of the past are balanced out by events in the present. And so when a 3-month-old baby dies, the members of the family could very well sincerely believe the event to be the appropriate reaping in the present of the evil actions sown by family members in the past. This is the kind of thing that Glenn Hoddle spoke about when he was England coach and he lost his job. And yet there are millions of people around the world who think like this. We see the theory of retribution in some forms of Judaism. Jesus' first disciples were influenced by it. We read in John 9, verses 1 and 2, as Jesus went along, he saw a man born blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" See, the disciples assumed his blindness was the direct result of someone's sin, his parents or his. The theory of retribution is alive and kicking in Christian circles. I remember a few years ago now, a Christian man whose wife suffered from a debilitating disease, whose son suffered from autism, and coming to believe that it was his or his fault, basically, that his family and he were suffering punishment for basically not meeting his full potential in serving God. And we might think, well, how sad's that? How foolish is that? But it's deep within our psyche. It's deep within mine. It's in us all. We reveal the way the theory of retribution has influenced us whenever we find ourselves thinking or saying, what have I done to deserve this? We're thinking I'm being punished for some reason. We're linking it to some particular sin. We're looking for the particular sin. What have I done to deserve this? It's alive there in each of our hearts. Intellectually, the theory of retribution is, in some sense, is satisfactory, even though it's almost impossible to prove. It accounts for every plane crash, every cancer, every bankrupt business. But in reality, it's a very rock-hard place to be. It's harsh. It provides no comfort whatsoever. In stark contrast, Job's sorrows teach us that our suffering may not be our fault at all. There is such a thing, according to Job, as innocent suffering. Job's sorrows leave it entirely open that suffering may not be a person's condemnation, but rather to their commendation. We think, oh, I'm suffering, it's to my condemnation. But Job opens up the story to us that, in actual fact, the reverse might be absolutely true, that it's actually to our commendation. I had an email from someone who Tanya and I related to and first met 20 years ago or so. This is someone I've not been in touch with for a long time. When we knew her 20 years ago or so, she was a young married woman whose brother, a teenager, had just died of leukemia. Her husband was seriously ill, had to be rushed into hospital by ambulance, and she had suffered problem after problem, pain after pain. She was one of those people for whom heartache after heartache just seemed to pile up for her. And she couldn't get into Oxford, to the hospital herself, so didn't have a car. So I gave her a lift, and as I drove her to the hospital, she turned to me in the car and she said, Tim, I must be doing something right. I must be doing something right. Now, I'm not God, I can't judge at all, but the book of Job leaves her words to be entirely possible. Innocent, doing things right. And in the midst of that, suffering terribly. Some suffering is directly due to sin, yes. But there is such a thing as innocent suffering. Of course, that doesn't make the question of suffering any easier. Like last week, as we were thinking about things then, in actual fact, it can make things more difficult. There are two words, again, last week we were looking at two words by way of just sort of applying these to our hearts, to ourselves, to our thinking. The first word is lament. Or if you like two words, straight away, Bible blues. Rather than making the question of suffering easier, the truth that there is such a thing as innocent suffering makes the question of suffering more difficult. Job, the Bible, rejects simplistic solutions. How do we live? How do we respond when there is no rhyme or reason for our suffering? Last week we thought about the fact that it's okay, it's right at times to be thoroughly bewildered at our suffering. Today it's absolutely right to lament. That's the Bible's terminology for singing the blues. In the midst of our suffering, to pour out our hearts with absolute honesty, the desperation of it all, the sadness of it all, the grief, the pain, the questions, to bring it all to Him. That's what Job does. He seems in chapters 1 and 2 to get through the initial shock of what had happened to him. Perhaps a little bit on autopilot. That's what happens when we hit tragedy. Shocked and dazed, we can get through the first week or so, perhaps the first 2 or 3 months. The funeral, simply on adrenaline. It's only down the line that we enter into a season when we begin to wrestle and struggle with all the questions and the deeper emotional things that are going on the longer term. Why has this been happening? Like Jacob wrestling all night with God, we find moments where we are wrestling night after night with the problem of suffering, and our hearts are shocked, and there's the emotion sometimes being numbed as we deal with our feelings. Job, that's what Job does. But he never curses God, as his wife told him to do. But he does curse the day of his birth, strikingly. Now look with me at chapter 3 and verses 1 to 10 of the book of Job. Let me read for you. At this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, 'A man is conceived,' let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those who curse it, who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan, let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes." It's desperate, isn't it? Cursing the day with word and phrase upon phrase, he does there in chapter 3, pouring out his heart to God. That's the big thing that he does. The question is, what's going on? What's the big question that he asks in his lament? Well, as the chapter goes on, look at chapter 3 and verse 11, we see it's why. He's asking why. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Verse 12, why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? And look at verse 16. Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? And then verse 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Why? It's as if Job is saying, I could put up with the suffering if only I knew a reason for it. The irrationality is hard to bear, Job says. And his heartfelt question rings true with us. Job wished he was dead. And he wished that all he had experienced of life and love and God had never been. His lament is filled with all these kind of desperate regrets, if only. And we may ask, are these the words of a righteous man? Cursing the day of his birth. Are these the words of a faithful man? Are these the words, the questions of a man who trusts God? At the end of the book, chapter 42, verse 7, God's view is that Job's bitter words did not affect his innocence. It is possible to grieve, to be angry, to say things that are almost bordering on blasphemous, seemingly some unhelpful things, but at the end of the day, Job receives no reprimand for God for his suicidal thoughts. God did not mind, as it were, Job being so candid about his feelings. Job was godly, but that did not make his suffering a breeze for him. He did not take his suffering in his stride. And it's so important for us to know this. And I think this is a lifelong lesson. It comes with years and it comes with experience, I think, and we need to be patient with ourselves and with our questioning and with our struggles and with our suffering to begin to learn more deeply what Job learned, to be able to pour out our hearts to God, to be plain with him, to be honest with him in the context of actually still trusting him. The first word is lament. I've already given you a clue as to the second word. The second word is faith. Lamenting faith. Job was angry. Job was thoroughly devastated, disappointed. But through it all, Job knew God. His lament, his blues, the wrestlings that were going on were the wrestlings of faith. Job knew God was there. He knew God was just. He knew God was loving. That's why perhaps he found things so difficult. He wrestled, he questioned, he was indignant with God. But it was all the struggle of a believer. Leaving God out of the question of suffering, though it might make certain things a little bit simpler, in the end it doesn't help. It would be like setting up a telephone helpline for atheists. When you dial the number, there's no reply. But God is there. He hears our laments. He is there for us to shout at, to cry out to in faith. At a very practical level, lamenting faith, I think, is vital. When suffering comes our way, we can suppress our emotions. And hear me on this. This is really significant pastoral advice. And advice that comes out of experience, my experience, other people's experience. When suffering comes our way, we can suppress our emotions. We can opt to wear a public front of piety or even have a triumphalist Christian sort of attitude to sort of make suffering a bit like water running off a duck's back and pretend that it's all okay. That is not Christianity. It's certainly not biblical Christianity. If we do, then we could end up physically or psychologically or emotionally or even mentally ill. And we could have also surrender to the emotions we endure in suffering. But that, again, could lead us to self-pity and deliberately withdrawing from other people, from fellowship, from friendship with other people. We don't want to suppress our emotions and we don't want to surrender to our emotions, withdrawing from people and activities and responsibilities and, as it were, close the door on life. That's the way to loneliness. And loneliness does not lead to recovery and restoration and being recuperated in ourselves and with the Lord and in our inner being and with our church family and friends. Job sorrows in his reaction to them. And God's commendation of Job through it all gives us permission to get angry about suffering, to deal with grief, to admit how bitter, how angry, and to speak to God about how brokenhearted we are. I'm not saying that grief is good, but that grief is wise. Grief is not good, but grief is wise. Lamenting faith. Godly grief is the acknowledgement that things are not what they ought to be. I read this in a briefing article some years ago now. A little girl always asked her mother to leave the hall light on and the bedroom door open when she was put to bed at night. Her mother asked her one evening, "Is it to let the light in?" And the little girl thought for a moment and then replied, "No, Mum. I think it's to let the darkness out." Grief is a bundle of complex negative emotions. It's a bit like darkness inside. It needs to be let out. It needs to be expressed in whatever ways are appropriate to our personality and our temperament and to our culture. When grief comes upon us, as surely as it will, and probably a number of times, we need to open the door and keep the door open long enough for the grief, for the darkness to get out. That's Ken Churchwood. Don't know who he is, but I think that's a fantastic piece of advice that he gives there. Times will come when the words "peace on earth," as it did for Bono, stick in our throats. times will come when we face suffering for which there is no reason, when there is no answer to the question why. For Job's sorrows teach us that there is such a thing as innocent suffering. How will we respond? How will we engage with it when it comes upon us? The encouragement here is to follow Job's example. In his sorrows he lamented, he sang the Bible blues. And in a moment we're going to sing, and I have struggled to find a song that fits in with the book of Job and Job's lamenting faith. There is a dearth of material out there that allow us individually or corporately as the Christian family to lament. Much of our songs are very triumphalist, and I don't want to heap that upon you as a burden for us as a church to try and put right. Of course, as that's our Christian culture. There is just something wrong with our Christian culture, I think, that means that it's difficult to find a song to sing after speaking about Job chapter 3. But there it is, that's for somebody else to serve the wider church and to perhaps be writing some laments. The Bible's got a number of them, and we should perhaps be encouraging someone to do a service for us all in that way. But lamenting faith is what we need to do. Maybe it's writing things down in a journal for ourselves. Certainly it might be going for a walk out in the Peak District and just unburdening our hearts and speaking out to the Lord God, talking to him, talking to ourselves on our own on a walk somewhere. Maybe it's just sitting quietly with a dear friend who'll listen to us and not be judgmental and pray with us. Now, we have a hope and a confidence, though, that Job never knew. And this is with this I want to draw to a close. We have something that he never knew. For we know the lament of another innocent sufferer. A totally, completely sinless, innocent sufferer. The sinless one who suffered, who spoke the words of lament and who asked why from the cross. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? As we sing the Bible blues, we know that the God of the Bible not only hears our lament, our lamenting faith, he knows all about suffering too. He hung and he died on a cross. And so turn finally, and I end with this, to Hebrews chapter 4. And verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Amen.